Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 23rd of September. I hope you are all, you know, in good shape. Had a lovely weekend. Very nice. Weather was certainly beautiful, if not passable, in most places and times. And I hope you were able to enjoy it in all of the ways it was presented to you. Good morning. Welcome. We have a great panel this morning. Wonderful group of individuals who are going to talk about the news of the day and a lot going on. So we'll talk about all of that coming up. And just a reminder, over the next several weeks up until the start of the fund drive on the 14th of October, we're going to be pausing every once in a while and doing these lockbox special panels. And we're going to have, I believe, three this week. And so those are an opportunity for us to talk about an issue, and we'll talk about that issue with an expert, some members of our panel, and then also give you the opportunity to help out our lockbox in some way, shape, or form. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about the reform of the Supreme Court, as well as just trying to protect democracy. And that will be a subject, and I'll give you more information on that as the morning unfolds today. In the meantime, let me remind you that today is what we would call a quote-unquote normal panel.
Sort of, kind of.
We're insulted.
given the four of us, you know, as normal as it can be. And we're going to and to do that. Well, I would ask you, but if you can help out the lockbox now, that's certainly appreciated. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. All right, let's get started. I'll introduce the group to you. Here they are. Terry Gibson is preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University. Good morning, Terry. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me. So if we're normal, what does that say about your other panelists on other days?
I think you know. You know?
Very good.
I think you know. And by the way, in my, and just on the sheet on my script, normal is in quotations.
So, oh, that's good to
yeah,
know.
You know, I think it's you know, it, people know normal when they hear it. It's like a Mapplethorpe thing. So
just a tad.
Okay. We welcome our good friend Jim Henler to the show, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI. Good morning, Jim Henler. How are you?
I'm doing good, Joe. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you very much. Very nice to have you on the program, as always. We also welcome political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post on the show. Hello, Libby. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine.
Okay.
Yeah, doing well. Doing extremely well. So let's get to the issues of the day. You can join in panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I was looking at the newspapers and online news sites last night, and the one article just amused me that said there's chaos in the Trump campaign. And I was looking around to see, oh, was this in 2016? Was this 2017?
No, you know? I saw something. I can't remember where it was. It came off of Empire Report, I think, where the GOP itself is torn, that there are so many people in the GOP who are not going to vote for Trump but can't say anything and don't support him.
Well,
and see what he's doing to the party. It's really interesting.
Or the opposite of some 400 to 500 people who are signing letters now saying that they are going to support Kamala Harris,
right,
who have worked,
right,
who are Republicans and have worked for Trump,
right,
and have had some duty within the previous administration. However, this article is just sort of an overall, and I think it was a good point. It's a good, we had a weekend. And this kind of brings a lot of different things together. So I one of the reasons that I liked it, a Republican who reportedly called himself a black Nazi, a false story about migrants eating cats and dogs, and a feud with Taylor Swift bring back a sense of chaos, which would indicate that the sense of chaos went away. But
not really.
Regardless, even by the standards of a head-spinning presidential campaign, Donald Trump's campaign over the last 2 weeks has been tumultuous. A period that began when Mr. Trump pushed baseless claims from the debate stage that immigrants in Ohio were stealing and eating household pets ended with him facing attacks over his support of the Republican candidate for governor in North Carolina, who referred to himself as a black Nazi on the message board of a pornographic website. In between, Mr. Trump invited Laura Loomer, a right-wing influencer known for promoting September 11th conspiracy theories, to join him at events commemorating the anniversary of the attacks. He urged a government shutdown, attacked a cornerstone of his own tax policy, and declared, "I hate Taylor Swift" on social media after she endorsed his rival, and at events intended to woo Jewish voters, said the Jewish people would be, quote, responsible if I lose the election, prompting fears of anti-Semitic reprisal. While Vice President Kamala Harris crisscrosses the battleground states, pressing her message about Mr. Trump being a danger to abortion rights, democracy, and the country's future, Republicans have been re-immersed in the kind of drama that has defined the former president's political brand for more than a decade. In the past, such a drumbeat of controversy in the final weeks of the campaign might have given voters pause, even prompting shifts in the race. But this year, the nation has met the crush of chaos with little more than a shrug, and some strategists say a desire to tune out the campaign altogether. "We are on overload with wild stories every news cycle," said David Kochel, a longtime Republican strategist and a veteran of several presidential campaigns. Quote, "It's absolutely overwhelming, the capacity of people to track politics. You can't keep up with it all. So a lot of people just tune it out." I will pause there in my reading of that New York Times article. Terry Gibson, let's begin with you. Do you understand the penchant to just wanting to tune it out?
Well, personally, sure. We're all exhausted. However, I do appreciate the media's effort to identify all of the things that might qualify as chaos, as they've listed there. But at least for me, I've come to sort of think about the Republican Party and its supporters as sort of this sort of living organism that just continues to morph and adapt as needed to kind of justify its existence, never really questioning whether something is right or wrong, just sort of taking it in as another part of its body that it needs to survive. I don't see any signs out there that that any of these items that are listed under the category of chaos seem to really be changing the behavior in the party, seem to be changing the behavior of the voters that support that party in any meaningful way. There's slight shifts here and there, but if you look at the polls that are out this morning, it continues to show that regardless of all of this chaos, Donald Trump still has a really good chance of becoming the next president. And it's terrifying. It's hard to explain, but it seems to be that there is just nothing that can happen within that party that they can't find some way just to absorb and justify.
Jim Handler.
Yeah, I sort of agree with Terry. You know, I think, you know, those of us who speak on this panel, in fact, most of your listeners, our listeners, are people who are actually interested in politics, paying attention to issues and things like that. A lot of the voters, I think, are more tuned to either a specific issue, to the personalities, et cetera. And, you know, the polling shows such interesting and different results. excuse me. So Steve Kornacki, who does is one of the best analysts of American politics on NBC, was on Meet the Press, and he was showing a different way of viewing what was going on without looking so much at the issues, looking rather at the change in positive views of Harris. And he showed, first of all, that the bump from the favorability back in, I think he started in July to now, she's gone up in a staggering amount. So even though she's only a little ahead of Trump has stayed flat She's been on a rise. But the most interesting thing is he actually analyzed which kind of voters you're seeing the most change in. And it's voters under 30, independents, black voters, and Hispanic voters. And those are all areas where people were saying Trump has to make some kind of major inroads to win. Now, that all said, what I'm more afraid of at this point is some of the political machinations going on, and we may get into that later. But just for example, Georgia has more or less made it. So I think no matter how their voters vote, their supermajority Republican government is going to get to choose who they put up as their electors.
Libby Post.
Well, you know, I think part of what's going on with the polling, at any rate, is they're polling likely voters. And you had a swell of people, hundreds, tens of thousands of people, registering to vote after Taylor Swift endorsed Harris, right? So they're not in the polls. They're not putting enough emphasis on choice and the issue of abortion, and that's going to bring women out. And if they're not, if they're only doing likely voters, all the new registrants are not part of that polling. And those people are going to come out to vote because the people who registered them are going to remind them to go out to vote. And it's only going to get ramped up more and more in the next, you know, leading up to November 5th. And I guess early voting has already started or is starting in some places, which I find it's a little hot. I mean, 10 days in New York is enough. You know, to do a month before is a little crazy. But anyway, you know, I think everybody needs to stay vigilant. And, you know, enough with the political violence, because all it does is feed into Trump and his warped scenario. But I, you know, I mean, Harris was in New York on Sunday, raised $27 million. They've got the money. She's out raising money over Trump, and they're putting money into down ballot races, which is very important. They want to make sure they take back the House, which I think they just might. I mean, we were out east on Long Island this weekend, okay, where I would have expected to see a lot more Trump signs, not necessarily in the Hamptons, which where we were, but, you know, in Suffolk County, right? Hardly any, maybe two or three, if that. We saw a number of Republican for Harris signs out in the Hamptons, which I found interesting. And I think that I don't think the polls are showing, like in 2016, they didn't show the support that was there for Trump because nobody wanted to admit they were going to vote for him. I'm not so sure that the polling on people is as credible or strong as it is when you poll on issues. And so, you know, we just all have to remain vigilant, do the work, go door to door, do everything, you know, go to Pennsylvania, go to Ohio, go to where people want to go, put up the lawn signs, show the support, and make sure that we win in November, because really democracy is on the ballot more than anything else. The future of our country is on the ballot. And if you think he's not going to implement everything in Project 2025, you've got another thing coming.
I think what you just said is very anecdotal regarding the lawn signs and so forth.
Right.
But to the point, though, that I've had this conversation with three or four people over the weekend that said, I'm not seeing all the signs that I would expect to see. And I'm not only hearing that, I was talking to my brother in North Carolina. I was just in South Carolina. And that has surprised me, that outpouring that you saw,
right?
That very vigilant pro-Trump screaming from the rafters does seem to be, and again, this is extremely anecdotal, non-scientific. Please do not get mad at me, Jim Henler. but it does seem to be muted.
And the thing is that, you know, lawn signs are psychological warfare. Lawn signs don't vote, right? And you go to somebody's house and they've got a lawn sign for X candidate, you go, and you're a Y candidate in the same race, and you go knock on the door. Oh, yeah, I'm supporting you, but somebody asked me to put up that sign. So, you know, somebody from X, Y, and Z party. So, you know, there's also that. But I think for Trump, the expression of his support in 2016 and 2020 through lawn signs, through signage, all of that is definitely muted this time around. And so I just, you know, we just need to be vigilant is the best thing I can say and stay focused.
You know, it is possible that you could be a voter who has decided, you know, I don't really need to put out that Trump flag anymore. I don't really need to put out that Trump yard sign. I don't need to wear that MAGA hat. I'm going to vote for Donald Trump, but I've learned that sort of wearing that feeling on my sleeve and promoting it just creates issues for me in terms of getting along with my neighbors. It's not really worth it. So I'm just going to go do what I'm going to do in the voting booth and just live my life and not be a walking advertisement for the Trump campaign. I mean, it's possible that it's muted, but yet the feelings of the voters have not really changed. And I'd be, you know, curious about how that really correlates with reality. And I guess we'll find out.
Yeah.
I think it's also important just to remember, although it's hard for us here in the Northeast to do so, we're not getting the same kind of messaging from either of these campaigns that you're getting if you are in the South or in the Midwest. It's just two different ways of living. You know, they can't escape it, whether they're on their phone or TV or cable or Netflix or podcast, wherever they are, they're being hit 24 hours a day with videos and mail and emails from these candidates in ways that we're not. And it has to really have some bearing on how they go about seeing this overall election. And you certainly couldn't blame them if they're exhausted.
Well, no, you can't blame them at all for being exhausted. I will say, I don't know about you all, but I have seen more Harris ads on television as if New York were a contested state.
You're seeing
state.
It on cable.
Yes, on
okay,
national
so
ads.
Okay, so they're national buys on cable, and you might see them during news adjacencies on broadcast.
Yeah, I mean, all during the football game, but, I mean, those are almost national ads as opposed to local ads.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So they're doing national buys.
Yes.
And so.
Which is interesting.
Well, I mean, you know, if you want to get to ostensibly some middle-of-the-road Trump, maybe not guy, you know, football is the right place to do it. And you have Coach Walls, and you have all of them. I didn't watch any games, so I don't know who's on the ads or not. But.
We've mentioned this fact before, but let's bring it up again, that they have the money.
Yes, they do. They do.
Yeah, they have the money.
And so, he doesn't.
I mean, still, he has a lot. I mean, he's bringing in a lot of cash, but not as not as much in comparison. All right, let's.
But he does have well funded super PACs that are working his behalf, and he does have Elon Musk. That's not nothing,
right?
No, that's very true. And again, I think to your point, Terry, we're gonna have, you know, we'll see exactly what impact that has, right?
Well, and there's been a lot of stories in some of the very The Hill, Politico, et cetera. About, you know, Trump has a meeting with some particular group. So Trump has said publicly abortion rules belong to the state, et cetera, et cetera. He's talked about transgender rules, et cetera. A group of conservative women with a lot of money asked him to sign a document saying he would oppose abortion, he would oppose, any kind of support of any kind for gender change, et cetera, et cetera. And they said it took him a couple days till he signed it. And the difference between the first ask and the second ask was how much money they put up. So, you know, I have trouble believing that Harris would take money from things she doesn't believe in the way Trump does, or
we'll
the way Trump changes his
opinion.
We'll
be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We welcome your letters as we discuss the state of the presidential race as we look at it on this Monday, the 23rd of September. And it isn't far away. It just isn't far away. And so we look at the polls. There are a new set of polls out. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. And I know these polls were alluded to by at least two of our panelists this morning, and I would just like to give you a little background on them. This the major one, of course, is the New York Times Siena College poll, which is showing that Donald Trump is seeing strength in Sun Belt battleground states. So that Donald Trump is ahead in Arizona and leading in tight races in Georgia and North Carolina. To me, what makes this the most most interesting is that even in the Times Siena polls, in these battleground polls, we've seen the numbers to be so close and within the margin of error. And in the state of Arizona and in the state of Georgia, the numbers that Trump is ahead by in the polls is fairly is by four or five points. So that's a much larger gap than it was just 2 or 3 weeks ago when it was, I believe, 2 points. Meanwhile, in North Carolina, it is still within the margin of error and still very much within just 2 points and a squeaker, as it were. But former President Trump still ahead of Vice President Kamala Harris in the state of North Carolina. As far as the Arizona race, Trump would be exceeding the margin of error, Georgia by a whisker, and would be firmly within the margin of error in the state of North Carolina. The article in the New York Times says voters across the Sun Belt say that Donald Trump improved their lives when he was president and worry that a Kamala Harris White House would not, setting the stage for an extraordinary competitive contest in three key states, according to the latest polls from the New York Times and Siena College. The polls found that Mr. Trump has gained a lead in Arizona and remains ahead in Georgia, two states that he lost to President Biden in 2020. But in North Carolina, which has not voted for a Democrat since 2008, Ms. Harris trails Mr. Trump by just a narrow margin. We should note that this poll was also taken prior to the kerfuffle happening within the North Carolina North Carolina governor's race, which we'll talk about in just a moment, although we did mention it at the top of the show. And all of these, this is the line from the Times, the polls of the three states taken present further evidence that in a sharply divided nation, the presidential contest is shaping up to be one of the tightest in history.
Yep. You know, I think so. In the Times story, there's a photo of Trump in his ranting mode, but there's a wonderful caption, which is the tepid response to former President Donald Trump's latest round of provocations reflects the nation's deep partisan splits and a sense that voters are inured to his style. And you know, when the cat story, when the I hate Taylor Swift, when the Black Lives, I mean, all of this stuff breaking in any normal place, in any normal way, you'd think it would impact people. And the fact that it's just not showing up anywhere in the polling, in the, you know, again, maybe it's anecdotally in the yard signs, but, you know, we'd have to go driving through the seven battleground states. The three Midwestern states are interesting because if Harris were to take the so-called blue wall that up north, then those become
Michigan,
much
Wisconsin,
less.
Yeah, Minnesota.
Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota. Then those become less important. If those become close, I mean, and it's just crazy, and it's really going to be determined, most people think, by who actually votes.
Right.
Trump is working very, very, very hard. I think Trump has stopped worrying about trying to win new voters. I think all Trump is trying to do now is make sure every one of those people that support him come out and vote.
And that's strategically a mistake because Harris is getting new voters. So,
I hope
you're right.
Go ahead, Terry.
I was just going to say, in some ways, it does show what a great job the Harris campaign is doing, because they have had to find a way to put this relatively unknown candidate out there and get people excited about them. By that, I mean that there is this known factor about Donald Trump. People know him. They've had a long time to get to know him. They've made up their mind about him. And I think it explains a lot about why there just seems to be nothing that he can do that really impacts their ability to support him or not support him. They've just decided that this guy has the ability to give them what they want, regardless of all of the negative aspects of his personality. They're not surprised. So it's really difficult to put a new person out there, really sort of overcome that. And I think the Harris campaign has done a great job of catching up very quickly where Joe Biden kind of left off. The challenge is how can Harris sort of go even further? How can she take it even further and really captivate and solidify those remaining couple of 100,000 voters out there that, for reasons that many of us can't understand, if you have to make up your mind, that's her big challenge. And she has to do that in a unique way in each state. Each state almost requires kind of a different message from the Harris campaign. And I know it must be incredibly challenging for them to figure out what that is.
Terry, can I ask you a question? One of the things that consistently confuses me is that voters in a lot of these states are saying my life was better off under Trump. And I'm sort of having trouble understanding that, because employment is higher in those states. Wages have gone up. Yes, inflation, you know, the gas price has gone up, but more of these people now have jobs. We've seen things. So is it that they just feel like, oh, abortion bans mean my life got better? Or does it mean, you know, having a conservative Supreme Court, which most of them, you know, when polled, don't seem to think is a big issue? So do you have any feel from, you know, your life in politics, it'll be yours too? You know, I just have trouble understanding why people who are in places whose lives got worse think they got better.
Their lives got better because the man in the White House hated the same people they did. And so they were able to reinforce their own personal biases because Trump was there and showing it was okay to hate blacks. It was okay to hate gays. It was okay to hate trans people. You know, all of the whole realm, right? It was okay to hate women. I mean, in a very real way. And okay to hate Jews. And so, you know, there were good people on both sides of that rally in Charlottesville. So I think that's what it speaks to. They have forgotten COVID and how badly it was bundled. They think the economy was better because they could hate whoever they wanted to hate and not feel bad about it. And that's really what this comes down to. That's how their life was better. Not money, not anything else. They'll say it now because no one's going to say, oh, he hates the same people I hate, so I feel better about him. But that's really what it comes down to.
Terry, anything else?
I think Libby summed it up pretty well. It's one of the problems that we have with this self-reporting aspect of polling is that you never really have a way of knowing what these answers mean, depending on however the pollsters ask the question. You know, if the pollsters are just asking, was your life better off with Donald Trump, if that's the question, there's so many ways to answer that. You can say yes, but what does that yes actually mean? And I think Libby points to what must be existing out there, that if for many, yes means that this person represented the way that I want our country to operate. They represented my biases. They represented my priorities in terms of just who I believe should have the power. That, you know, I want the white people to have the power, mm-hmm. and I want men to have the power. It must mean that for many of them. But I do think you do see polling where questions are asked very specifically, very direct. And on both sides of the aisle, you do see evidence that regardless of maybe how it was, people's memories are a little off and don't quite remember the reality of it. But at the end of the day, that yes could just mean that I'm still really unhappy with how much I have to pay for rent. I'm still really unhappy with how much I have to pay at the grocery store. I'm still really unhappy with what it costs to just live. And it might very well mean that. But I think that Libby's summation of it is probably more often than not the truth.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We welcome you, and we'll continue on this subject with your letters right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We welcome you, and we'd love to hear your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to our letters, and let's see. We have many, so we'll get to as many of them as we can get to. Lauren says, polls aren't news. Please stop treating them as such. Polls weren't especially accurate back in the 80s when everybody had a landline and nobody screened their calls. They're just this side of meaningless today. Do you want to address that real quick in real time, Jim?
Yeah, I will. To some degree, that's completely right. Who gets polled, how they get polled, really is based on models of who comes out to vote. And those at the moment are always guesses, right? They used to be very predictable. You could say this many people are going to almost definitely go Democrat, this many are almost definitely going to go Republican, and this is the middle, and we can see what's happening in the middle. Now that middle is very small. So we're talking about, when you talk about the margin of error in a poll, you're talking about a mathematical thing, not a thing about whether the poll is right or wrong. When things are in that range, that basically means the poll simply, the models aren't strong enough to predict the small slice of people who are still going to be determining this thing. The other thing that I think a lot of people are worried about in the Democratic Party is that Trump has always consistently underpolled. So the number for Trump has of voters has traditionally come out above the number that the polls showed.
No one wants to admit they're going to vote for him.
Well, that may be some. I think more the issue is that rural voters tended not to come out much. So they were largely discounted in the national polls. Now, rural voters in the seven swing states are much more powerful. But the polling still can't quite catch up with that, because how do you find somebody who lives in the middle of nowhere and is going to drive an hour to go vote, you know, go vote for Trump somewhere?
But
and so,
so this letter writer is specifically talking about the difference between landline and
right.
cellular phones.
Oh,
have,
I see.
Have
yeah.
they gotten over
well, yeah,
that
I mean,
bump?
No. They haven't. It's more and more difficult now to complete a poll, and now they have people just going online to do it, which I find a little, one poll per IP address, which means, okay, then only I can answer the poll in my house, not me and Lynn, right? So there's that. So it's a very difficult situation. And it's when you're doing grassroots outreach, it's really hard to do voter ID, to do phone banking now because, we're
spam
watching
risk.
TV, we're watching Castle at 8 o'clock, whatever, mindless television, and the phone rings and it comes up on the
Castle.
On the screen, spam, and
yeah.
we let it go. We don't answer.
And 20 to 35-year-olds are anything.
Yeah,
yes,
Castle.
Dear, Castle.
Okay.
Sorry, it's like...
It's an oldie but a goodie.
Well, it's, I started doing it during recovery because I needed something to watch that was mindless. There are times, Terry, that I just need to watch mindless television so I can do my work.
Matlock with Kathy Bates.
Yeah, right. So, I know, that'll be a lot of fun, won't it? I'm looking forward to that.
But the other thing is you can't even get you're not even getting the television...
Right.
results when you're talking the 20 to 35-year-olds,
right.
when you're talking streaming. But But what I will say is the pollsters have gotten more sophisticated about how they are reaching out to people. They're not using just landline cell phones. God, I get a million polling emails per day to my cell. But the issue is if someone calls you up and says, will you answer a poll? And you say no and hang up, right? That doesn't count as one of the people polled. That counts as somebody who wasn't polled. And you know, what reason did that person hang up for is not. So even with landlines, there were always issues. And so, again, polls are based on mathematical predictions based on previous behavior compared to current answers. And those are just as the margin of people who are in that middle gets smaller, statistically knowing what's going on gets smaller, regardless of the polling method. So I think the person is right. During the landline times, polling was better, but it wasn't just the landlines. It was also the political climate in the late 70s, early 80s was very different.
Well, on the polling aspect, and just to address the letter writer's concerns, I think we should all be leery of polling. We should all take a look at it from a distance, and it's just a part of the puzzle. But yeah, we should acknowledge that there is a massive multi-billion-dollar industry out there that revolves around polling. There are many, many, many organizations, both on the right and the left, that do this for a living, and campaigns hire them, and not just candidate campaigns, advocacy campaigns hire them as well. Super PACs hire them. One issue advocacy campaigns trying to get something passed at a state level hire them. There is a need when you are running for office or where you are marketing a product or trying to get a piece of legislation passed to have some idea of what the people are thinking about this issue or thinking about you. And there is a need to try to figure out how to put together a strategic message that aligns with their beliefs and their values so that you can persuade them. And without having access to them through this polling, it's very difficult to figure out how to spend your limited resources. Much of the money that Harris' campaign is raising, and she's raising a lot of it, is going towards some type of survey or polling or focus groups to try to figure this stuff out, because you want to invest that money in the best way possible. So when these commercials hit your TV screen, they are a result of significant messaging that has come from polling. And so there is some validity to it. Otherwise, this industry wouldn't be as big as it is. But again, one poll does not say everything. But when you're looking at multiples and multiples and multiples of polls, it does begin to add up. And these campaigns are internally doing their own polls in multiples that are much bigger than we're seeing every day. And I think much of the messaging, certainly from the Harris side, is a result of what they're seeing in the polls.
Let me roll through as much mail as I can before we have to take a break at the top of the hour. John writes, gas and grocery prices were better under Trump. He said he had the best economy ever, but he needs to explain what he did to make it better. We know he rode in on a great economy, so he needs to answer the question what he did and not wiggle out of it. Then we go to Amy, who says, I have friends who tell me it's about the economy and that Trump will do a better job. I assume it's because they watched the stock market go high under Trump. Your thoughts on how to refute this?
It's pretty high right now.
It's the highest it's ever been.
Right. Who are they kidding?
It's record high. I mean, but that's the part I don't understand. I do understand. But when the stock market goes down, people say, see, that's a bad sign, and it's the president's fault. When it goes up, they're like, oh, the stock market always goes up, right? I mean, it's like...
The problem now is the stock market is going up, but inflation is still a problem, and that's because the companies, the corporations, are giving their shareholders massive profits, and they're doing that by keeping pricing falsely inflated.
Well, I think that's part of it. I think the other thing is... There's something in social science. I was just talking to a colleague who's a well-known social scientist, in fact, was one of the guests on our show recently, who pointed me at some literature that I then started looking at. And this is my name for it, but I'm going to call it the gas price effect.
Mm-hmm.
People are not rational when it comes to gas prices, right? But it's a number that's in your face all the time. But interestingly enough, if gas was $3.25 last week, is $3.35 this week, you say gas prices are going up, regardless of the fact that it was $4 last year. And so, and the other thing is, if you think about how much it costs to fill your car, it seems like a lot of money. When you do the difference between this place and the place down the street, which seem to have very different numbers, you know, you're talking a dollar, you're talking $2. So in your actual budget, unless you're a truck driver or somebody who has to do very long commutes, the gas price almost is invisible in your budget. But it's absolutely in your face, and it's these in-your-face numbers, the stock market numbers, the gas station numbers, the cost of eggs thing that people really are seeing. And then I'll stop there because we'd have to get into things like homophily and things like that. But people reinforce each other's opinions around that stuff. So that's the other thing.
Let's go back to the letters. These two are for Libby. I'm going to read them together, Libby.
Okay.
Matthew says, Libby makes a pretty bold and sweeping interpretation about why people think their lives were better off under Trump. In essence, mutual hatred. On what basis does she make this interpretation? What data or research is she drawing from? That letter, followed up by this one, who this is called Libby Lost It. What the heck is Libby talking about? Life was better because we were able to hate everybody? If the panel stands behind those comments, you then have clearly become the problem.
I'm not saying life was better because we were all able to hate everybody. I'm saying life was better for, they think their life was better because the person in the White House hated the same people they did. And so they felt some kind of validation of their feelings. Look, folks, you know, all you got to do is look back at January 6th, look back at Charlottesville, Jews will not replace us. Look back at, you know, go beat him up at the 2016 convention and making fun of the disabled reporter. Yeah. You don't need science, although there have been articles that bear this out, to see that we're dealing with a group of people who felt totally disenfranchised. These are folks who never came out to vote because they didn't think their vote would ever make a difference. Totally disenfranchised, totally alienated because, oh, you know, that person over there with dark skin is taking my job. Well, that person over there with dark skin happens to be a radiologist. Did they really take your job? I don't think so. But nonetheless, you can keep thinking that way. So it's always been about race. And I have been saying this since 2015. It's always been about race. It's always been about hate. And Trump has capitalized on that. And he knows it. And he just keeps triggering people's emotions.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue to trigger your emotions. And we welcome you to,
whatever,
to respond. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will return after news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. Libby Post, Jim Handler, and Terry Gibson making up the group this morning. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. A reminder, we're going to be doing some more lockbox specials this week on the panel. You can help out today by going to panel. By going to WAMC.org. That's where you go. WAMC.org, and you can help the lockbox this morning. Also, let's go to some letters. We'll finish up and then we'll move on to other topics. I'll roll through these pretty quickly. And if, panel, you have anything that you'd like to add, please let me know. Kathleen writes, I agree with Libby. The main driver of Trump voters these days is that Trump gives them permission to hate. I used to want to see him in a jail cell. Now I hope that President Harris will let him get in his plane and escape to Venezuela and that the media can finally ignore him. At the end of the Hollywood movie, he will wander into the jungle where the cocaine hippos live and be gone forever. The cocaine hippos was not a word I thought I would say, words I would say on this morning's program. Then Kathleen writes, Paul Schmoles, no one on the panel was mentioning the Fox News influence.
Yeah.
I just think you always know it's there, right? I assume that our listeners know that the Fox News influence is always there, as well as immigration, which is what my Fox friends and relatives are talking about, and they're planning on voting for Trump, which is, I mean, one of the reasons why we had a whole panel on this topic of immigration last week.
Yes, well, the immigrants are taking all our money because of welfare, and they're stealing all our jobs because they're working so hard.
Right. It's just astounding.
So, yeah.
Makes absolutely no sense.
Russ says, though the evidence is tenuous at best, the Trump campaign has convinced the body politic that the federal government created inflation. Unless Harris can come up with some very successful counter to this belief in her economic speech this Wednesday, the Electoral College will spell doom for her campaign. Do you think it comes down to one speech, Terry?
One speech? No, I don't think this campaign comes down to one speech or one poll or one campaign ad. It's a collective of all the things that are going to be happening. There's still a lot of time between now and Election Day, and
that's right.
And how both campaigns perform and get out there in front of the public and speak is going to make a difference. I'm glad to see Harris pushing for a second debate. That would be helpful, I think, for her campaign. I think she needs that, and I think it would be harmful for the Trump campaign. So I understand why they're resisting it. But no, it is all about a series of statements, a series of messages that ultimately will decide who these few remaining undecided voters vote for. And it also will depend a lot on what their friends and family and neighbors and even the influencers in the media have to say about it. Those are also very powerful persuaders.
So I just want to say something on the Fox effect. You know, we keep calling Fox the right-wing media. There is a large portion of the Trump base that believes Fox is middle or even left. They have turned to radio stations that are, you know, the ones that used to have Rush Limbaugh now have people who make Rush Limbaugh look moderate. They are turning to local TV stations that have just, you know, the FCC. So Fox can lie by saying, we have heard people saying this lie. But if Fox says, we made this up, they're in trouble. They're right. Small stations in the middle of nowhere that have local audiences, whether radio, television, newspaper, can just go with the Ohio story, can go with whatever story they want. And, you know, there's no enforcement at that level. It would be almost impossible. So I think what we call the Fox effect is real. But I think you need to understand it goes way beyond Fox. And, you know, I was telling someone the other day, and they were stunned to learn this. So at one point, so if you go into almost any military installation or waiting somewhere in a waiting room, there's always a TV on, just as in most places now. And there was a rule for many years that they could only stream CNN. This was when CNN was the only news-only station. When Fox came along, they allowed the military to choose whether they were going to do Fox or CNN. I have not since then, and it's been, I think, 15, 20 years, seen a single military place I've walked in which didn't have Fox on. Okay, so, you know, that's the other thing. It's influencing not just the base, but throughout. And then you have this, the real haters who've even moved further to the right, just like, you know, moving to Truth Social.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the problem is things from there come to the mainstream. So if nobody would ever take what Trump says on Truth Social and publish it elsewhere, there'd be a small number of people who'd ever see it. But he says something crazy on that. He doesn't have to put it on Twitter. He doesn't have to put it out. The media will pick that up for him. The I Hate Taylor Swift was a good example. No one would have ever noticed. Probably it's not in his favor that they did, but they did.
Let's go to Kurt, who says, good morning. Pretty crazy how out of touch the panel is with American people. Americans thinking their life was better under Trump had zero, and I mean zero, to do with race or gender. Stop making something up to fit your agenda. It had to do with gas prices. It had to do with food prices. It had to do with the fact that people cannot pay their rent because rent increases were so substantial. Being better under Trump had to do with people who were able to buy a home where now it's out of touch. As a landlord, I had to raise my rent $350 each. This is not about male, female, lesbian, gay, black, Chinese. Zero to do with any of that. All to do with living, quality of living. This panel is really in the clouds.
Okay.
Then we go to Warren's. Polls aren't news. Please stop treating them as such. Polls weren't especially accurate. I think I read that one already. I apologize that it slipped back in. Then, Wendy, my experience is that the Harris Walls campaign doesn't have a lot of lawn signs to distribute, at least in the Capital District. I ordered our sign from the campaign about a day after Joe Biden withdrew his candidacy. The sign arrived about 3 days ago. Don't discount the impact of the lateness of Kamala's candidacy had on the basic communication medium. Also, if the signs they do have are going to places like Pennsylvania and Michigan, I can't argue with that decision.
Well, I can. Can I say something about signs?
Of course.
There are signs available at the Albany County Democratic Committee at 21 Colvin. They're $10 a pop. If you're interested in getting one, you can reach out to me through the station, and Joe will forward your information to me, and I'll tell you how you can get one. So yeah. There are signs. There
are
plenty of signs.
We're not endorsing that, of course, but we're just saying that.
No, right, but there are plenty of signs up there, and so there you go.
All right, let's go to, speaking for myself as a single woman Democrat, says Pat, a childless cat lady, I took such a flaming on old Twitter that even from some male coworkers that I decided it wasn't safe to put Hillary signs on my lawn in 2016. I think the aggressiveness of Trump supporters keeps people like me uncomfortable with signs or bumper stickers. Let's move on to another issue as we work through our topic list this morning. And, of course, the story that broke last week that we haven't really discussed in any detail is that of, and we've touched on it this morning, but, again, not in any real detail, is senior staff members for North Carolina gubernatorial hopeful Mark Robinson resign amid porn site scandal. So the story that we really haven't talked about a lot is the scandal itself. But now a slew of staff members have resigned from Mark Robinson's campaign for North Carolina governor. His old post he allegedly wrote on a porn site upended his campaign and threatened the GOP's prospects in a key battleground state. Robinson's campaign announced Sunday that four senior leaders had stepped down, the campaign manager, the general consultant, the finance director, and the deputy campaign manager. Those said that the director of operations, the deputy finance director, and two political directors have also left. That leaves Robinson with a skeletal team just 6 weeks out from Election Day.
Oops.
I appreciate the efforts of these team members who have made the difficult choice to step away from the campaign, and I wish them well in their future endeavors. Robinson, the lieutenant governor of North Carolina, said in a statement, I look forward to announcing new staff roles in the coming days. He had a chance to get out of the race still hit a deadline, and then he, along with the Republican Party within the state of North Carolina, declared that he was in it and he was going to continue to be in it, and said that he was not going to leave. So the departure came days after a bombshell CNN report linking Robinson to the account of a porn site user who once argued for the reinstatement of slavery, detailed an affair with his wife's sister, and called himself a black Nazi. The Washington Post also obtained screenshots of the post and found that the username Mini Soldier praised Adolf Hitler's book Mein Kampf, Robinson has denied writing the post. The state Republican Party stuck by Robinson, but GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump has distanced himself, and Robinson was conspicuously absent at Trump's rally this weekend in Wilmington, North Carolina. Trump, who endorsed Robinson in the GOP primary, has not addressed the past week's controversy, but previously had referred to him as Martin Luther King on steroids. Okay.
I think opioids might have been the better. You know, what I found interesting about this article is you had to read it carefully, because normally what happens when some of these things happen is you read this article that, you know, he's fired his campaign staff. This is people who resigned because they said, I can't stand to work for this guy anymore. That's pretty amazing.
And or they know he's going to lose.
And then the other thing that I think is interesting in this space, there's a lot of how they actually figured out who it was and that it really was him. But Trump has, there's always been a political strategy called a lie, deny it, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Trump has made that into an art form, and that's what Robinson is counting on, is just being able to say, I didn't do it. This is just the media trying to get at me. CNN, that liberal media, CNN is after me. And frankly, I suspect there are some voters who that's going to bring them out because of the craziness. But he's, you know, always been a long shot behind Stein, apparently, given the way things are going. I think what will be interesting is to see if this hits the downstream votes, because, you know.
Or upstream. I mean,
the presidential. But also, right now, in North Carolina, the GOP has a supermajority. They don't care who the governor is. If Stein wins and the current, and none of the current assembly members, none of the current North Carolina legislature changes, then he won't be able to do anything. But if that starts to swing, if they lose the supermajority, that means if he vetoes something, they can't overrule it, and that would have huge impacts on issues, particularly the issue of abortion and women's rights.
Terry?
Yeah, on the staff resigning, when you decide to go work for a political candidate, certainly somebody who's running for governor, you have to have some belief in that person. You have to have some respect for that person. And it does reflect on you that you've decided to go work there. So them leaving may be more simply a result of the campaign no longer being able to pay them, because it's hard to raise money when you're out there advertising yourself as a black Nazi. It could be that simple. On the front of whether this will have any impact on the actual other races, like the presidential race or the state legislative races, I think that depends a lot on how Mark Robinson and how the media, how they cover Robinson and what he gives the media to cover between now and Election Day. This story could quickly just kind of go away, and that it just becomes clear that he has no chance of winning. It's not worth promoting himself anymore. He's going to run out of money, probably have no staff to operate. So it might just go away. But if he continues to stay relevant somehow and the media continues to cover him because it's an interesting story, then I think it does become potentially problematic for the Republicans to distance themselves from him.
All right, let's go to another topic this morning as we head to our bottom of the hour break, and then we'll start to wrap up. Congress unveils a short-term spending deal. Speaker Mike Johnson dropped his demands for proof of citizenship voting requirements to strike a deal that includes more money for the Secret Service and funds the government through December 20th. And congressional leaders from both parties unveiled a short-term agreement to fund the government after Speaker Mike Johnson abandoned demands for a longer-term deal that also included new proof of citizenship requirements for voter registration. The deal, which extends federal appropriations through December 20th, includes an additional $231 million to help the beleaguered Secret Service protect candidates during the upcoming presidential election and into next year. According to the Treasury Department, the United States has spent about $6.3 trillion in fiscal 2024, which ends on September 30th. The timeline of the deal allows Congress to sidestep a government shutdown during the campaign season, but it all but ensures that spending disputes will dominate the lame duck period between the election and the inauguration of a new Congress in January of 2025. Libby.
Well, I think Mike Johnson knows that when the Republicans shut down the government, it doesn't bode well for them in November. So he made sure that that wasn't the case. The whole proof of citizenship thing. I mean, before this Supreme Court, I would have said, oh, it'll go to the Supreme Court and they'll call it unconstitutional. But you never know what this Supreme Court would do. But this is all about politics and making sure that they're not blamed, the GOP isn't blamed for a shutdown.
I know we've been criticizing polling today, but there was a poll that showed that 75% of Americans were opposed to a government shutdown, and that a significant portion of that was the significant portion of Americans would blame the GOP. And even within the GOP, you had, I believe it was, it was either a slight, I think it was against the shutdown, but it was very close. But again, it was clearly something where if it had happened, it would have been very bad for them, and especially that close to an election. And it would have given such an easy message to Harris and Waltz.
Go ahead.
It's a good example I was saying before, and that politicians, especially at the level of Mike Johnson, they are definitely listening to polling. Maybe it's not accurate, but it's all they have to work with. They have to have some reasonable sense that the actions they're taking will be supported by their base. And outside of polling, there isn't really another way to go about doing that right now. Nobody's come up with a better system. And they saw what everybody else saw, that the election is incredibly close, and nobody wants to be taking responsibility for shutting down the government right now.
What is it about? I mean, we were talking about the whole, I think a week ago, week and a half ago, we were talking about immigration and what Johnson wanted in this. And, I mean, it seemed like it was going to be dead then, but there was a discussion about it, and obviously there are many in the Republican Party who are quite upset that he caved as he did. So what do you think happened in a relatively short period of time that said, okay, this is something that we absolutely have to do? Because it seemed, and I understand all the points that you just made, but you could have made those points a week ago too, right?
Right, sure. But I think it all became really obvious, and probably Trump made a phone call, you know, or his people made a phone call. But, you know, it is what it is in terms of when they shut down the government, the party that does it gets blamed, and it's not a good thing politically. You know, I think what's changed is the polling is showing that Harris is gaining. And we've got 6 weeks for her to continue to gain, and they don't want to do anything that would jeopardize Trump winning. Not that it's a guarantee, okay? And so I think this is all political. We know that the whole citizenship thing. I mean, look, they were. I think it was Arizona tried to throw hundreds of thousands of people off the ballot, right? And the judge said, no, you can't do that. So even the lower level courts are getting recognizing that the Republicans are trying to capitalize on voter suppression. And they just need to, I think the Republicans recognize that this would not be very good for them if they shut down the government. And the thing is this, is that the Freedom Caucus is in line here because they too recognize what needs to happen. If they shut down the government, what that would mean, because it would also impact congressional races, because you'd be able to use that in a congressional race to say, vote for the Democrat, we don't shut down the government, right? It will have an impact on other races as well, down ballot. So they did what is politically expedient.
Well, and I think the other thing that's come out in some of these articles has been the how long the extension would be. So by moving it into December, right, they're moving it to where the current Congress will get to make the next decision. I would not be surprised if the Democrats win but don't take the House and or Senate, that you see a government shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
Because once the election's over,
they don't care.
They don't care. Right. And that would then, again, just be a way to mobilize their base for the next things coming up.
Well, this gets into some of the things that Jim hinted at before, and that due to some of the political machinations we're seeing at state levels, especially by the Republicans, well, definitely by the Republicans, Georgia being the lead case at the moment, it's conceivable that we might not even know who's president in December when this comes back up and they have to negotiate how to keep the government open. It's possible that some of the Senate and House races may not be decided yet due to these various political machinations. Many of these races may be in the court. The presidential race may be in the Supreme Court. I think we're going to be looking at a pretty ugly election day where a lot of unknowns. It's going to be what we saw back during the Gore-Bush campaign on steroids. We thought hanging Chad was a big deal back then, but it's going to be something 10 degrees worse than that, I'm afraid.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up with our group this morning. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll continue right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussions this morning. And we welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Very nice to have you with us this morning. All right. We got about 15 minutes or so and time to get to a few more topics. So we'll do exactly that and welcome you. Let's go to this discussion, which is where I'm going to go to my colleague Jim Henler and ask him to try to explain this. I will tell you that this is something that we were talking about during the break with Libby as well, and it is we realize it's a tragic story, but it's also figuring it out is kind of key and something that is it's scary. And we're talking about the pager attacks that we've seen over the last 2 weeks. And pager attacks bringing to life long-feared supply chain threats is the headline in the Washington Post. Everyday electronics rigged to explode reflect the near impossibility of securing modern, globalized electronics supply chains. And with that, with those scant few words, I will turn over to Jim Henler as the deadly attack that caused thousands of pagers used by members of Hezbollah to explode Tuesday shines a spotlight on an inconvenient truth. It's virtually impossible to secure the modern electronic supply chain against a determined and sophisticated adversary.
That sort of says it all. If you have a cell phone, there are parts of that cell phone that have been made in tens of countries, okay, including China, including other countries, which currently we have tension with, let me say. Okay, so now let's say something led to a war in Taiwan, us versus China. Now all those Chinese parts, again, Are our machines safe? Yes, at the moment. But like if you were buying new ones later, you'd want to be very... The federal government has been being careful for a long time. We actually have procurement rules that say anything going into, for example, a fighter plane has to be purchased through... Everything has to be domestic, and it has to be tested and things like that. But, of course, that's why the fighter planes cost so much more than your cell phone. And, you know, and some of these things are things you'd never think of. So, for example, the hurricane in Puerto Rico during COVID had a major impact because it turns out Puerto Rico is where the majority of those bags, the intravenous plastic bags, are made. So suddenly the U.S. had a shortage of saline drip bags at a time it needed it significantly. Wow. So supply chains are very, very complicated. Companies worry about what's called resilience of my supply chain. How do I make sure that if something goes wrong in one place, I can keep doing it? You know, a national government can afford to make sure some of the stuff they're buying. A terrorist group has a lot harder time. So no one knows where in the supply chain things were done, who did it, how they got in. You know, the Israelis have become very famous for their cyber sophistication. And, you know, we saw the same thing. The Hamas leader who was killed in Iran, the bomb had been planted in the apartment he stayed 3 months earlier. But, you know, how many other places were there bombs on? So if you know, so somehow Israel got wind of the fact that Hamas, being scared about cell phones, because there was a lot of issues on whether the Israelis could hear everything they were saying on the cell phones, decided to move to a pager-based approach. Somehow Israel got wind of that, figured out where the pagers were coming from, figured out where in that they could insert something, and were able to do it. And, you know, the U.S., again, the U.S., our intelligence agencies, et cetera, have been paranoid about this for a lot of years. And there's almost nothing we can do because the cost of making all your supply chain secure is huge. But mostly, now let me make people feel better. Most of your consumer products, you don't have to worry about this. If you're a member of a terrorist group and not you're so buying much stuff cheap from the ally of someone who hates you, you might want to be a little more careful than you used to be.
Wow.
What? I mean, it really makes you wonder, right? I mean, so who has access and when, and do we know that?
In this particular case, certainly nothing has come up in public. In the old days, I might have known the answer and not been able to tell you. But I no longer have any clearances or anything. So these things play out at very high levels of clearance. Because, again, the minute somebody knows one of these attacks is possible, it becomes useless, right? So if someone in Hamas, in Hezbollah had said, hey, something weird's going on with my pager, and someone had looked at it and said, oh my gosh, you know, message would have gone out instantly to everybody, get rid of them. And in fact, there's a lot of speculation that originally the pager explosions, the current attacks on military sites in, you know, Hezbollah sites in southern Lebanon, et cetera, was meant to be a coordinated effort at probably a later time, and that there's reason to believe that there was some people in the government who were in the leadership who were becoming suspicious of the pagers, which meant Israel had to set them off right then and there. A lot of people say, you know, the civilian casualties were horrible. I agree completely. And the answer is, it probably was not planned to be that. They probably planned to have it go off at a time where you had a large Hezbollah meeting, or where you had, you know, people would be known to be in a place where it was going to do it. But having to set it off early or not at all, you know, becomes a very complicated political decision.
What's the time frame in the sense of meaning? How new are the pagers? And I mean, could they lie dormant for weeks, months, years?
So the speculation on this one is months. Some of the things that come out, so I forget the name of the specific, the spyware that was being planted in iPhones and similar, I think also in other cell phones, by government, again, you know, they could purchase this and do it. That stuff was there for a couple, I think 2-3 years before it came out that it was there. And it came out because of a news leak, not because anyone discovered it on the devices. So, you know, this is very subtle and sophisticated stuff. And again, you know, the good news is don't worry about your laptop blowing up because of this. If your laptop blows up, it's because the batteries are bad, which is another whole story.
That's reassuring.
But if you're working for, again, an organization that where these threats could be real, you have to do it. But ransomware, things like that, you know, I'm not going to go into my Voxpox spiel where we've been talking about Ray about another cybersecurity one of these days. But again, this is a growing issue. The good news is we're trying to educate people about it and things like that. But the supply chain stuff, the subtle stuff, the spyware stuff, that's really played out at a very, very high level. And it's not the kind of thing you're going to learn about in a college course.
The Terry, anything on that you'd like to add?
No, I just think I'm going to go back to like the old cup and string form of communication. And
I know.
Just get rid of all my electronic devices. I mean, if you are into conspiracy theories, this story is, and I think Jim has just added lots of reasons for you to be suspicious. You know, I'm wondering about my coffee pot that was made in China. Should I worry about that?
Let me just tell you a funny story, which is that I was and this has now come out publicly, so I'm allowed to say it. So, someone at the CIA, when I was visiting there at one point, was telling me the story of they were sweeping one of their floors and they discovered a Wi-Fi signal that was unaccounted for, which, I mean, again, is very problematic for them. And they searched and searched and searched, and they finally found it. It was in a dishwasher that had been recently installed, and you know, dishwashers nowadays have Wi-Fi built in so that if something breaks or somebody can do diagnostics, things like that. It's a very good feature unless you're trying to make sure there's no Wi-Fi. So sorry, Terry, just don't buy anything. You're going to have to go completely off the grid if you do it. But seriously, these things are very difficult. They're very expensive to pull off. They're very complicated to put into the works. And
so very difficult
really
to very difficult to pull off. And so let me just end with this question, I think, which is, so is there kind of like an Apple Android thing here in the sense of that if I'm looking at the supply chain and the pagers, that it gets down to who pushes the button to make them go off. Am I going to know where they are and what? And exactly how many devices are going off? Do I have that information?
Who is the I?
Whoever is commanding the attack.
I mean, the answer is, to a certain degree, yes, and to a certain degree, no. I mean, they know exact second they're going to set off they set off the attack. They can tell via various techniques whether somebody has been getting close to discovering it. But I think whether they can know where every single one of them is, how many, et cetera, that's much harder. And again, I don't know that level. That that takes you from cyber to spycraft, right? That's, you know, somebody had to know that these pagers were being ordered, from where they were being bought and who was buying them and how they were going to get to people. And, you know, that didn't come about because of a cyber thing. That, you know, somebody was paid to tell somebody else who told, you know, however.
Right.
So traditional spying hasn't gone away. If anything, it's grown.
And all right. Well, hopefully we clear that up for you, but I doubt it.
Everyone's much more confused.
Yes,
now,
but we'll give it a shot.
Let me just simply say, and by the way, you should be concerned, but don't be too concerned.
Yeah, that is that's no diss on Jim, of course. I'm just trying to figure it out. All right, we have we are out of time. I want to thank everybody who was with us. Very nice to have you here, and we thank you all. Terry Gibson, Jim Hemler, and Libby Post, thank you so much. Wonderful to have you all here. We'll be back right after
this. Pleasure.